Well, yet one more time, we have been overtaken by events. It's happened over and over again. We plan a Talk of Alaska subject, and then events in the news suddenly turn the high beams on it. And this time, well, they've recalled 500 million eggs when we were going to talk about food security. I'm Steve Heimel. Alaskans are experts in preserving food. Let's share how we do it. From wherever in the state you are, our number toll-free, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, email talk at aprn.org. Putting food by is the subject today on Talk of Alaska. Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
So, of course, all the buzz is about election here at the network offices, and Dave Donaldson from Juneau is in town and staying in a hotel, and so he orders breakfast this morning. He says the eggs were just terrible. They cooked them too hard. I said, well, that's what the feds are saying you got to do with all your eggs right now. That's the latest direction, is that you don't want your eggs half raw. You don't want eggs sunny side up all over the place. People are cooking eggs hard now, and that's all because of this recall from a couple of farms in Iowa who turn out to provide everybody and their brother with their different brands of eggs. And they're still trying to figure out how many different brands they're going to be. Later on in the show, we'll be talking more specifically with Patrick Woodall, Director of Research at the Food and Water Watch, about consolidation in the food industry, food processing, industrial food, and so forth like that. But I think there are plenty of Alaskans that would just as soon avoid as much as possible food that comes out of the agribusiness complex for this reason, but many others as well. Among other things, if your food is closer to you, it's just plain more secure. You know where it comes from. And every show we've done on the subject of food security has drummed up a very enthusiastic response from our listeners. We did a show on I talked to a guy out in Bethel who is basically using waste heat to help kick his agricultural production into turbo, and got into this conversation about root cellars. And pretty soon everybody in the state is calling up, telling us the specifics of how to bury a Connex to make a root cellar. Now, that only in Alaska would something like that happening. So much fun to do this type of show and have everybody connected all across the state. And I'm looking forward to what people have to say about their food preservation techniques, because there are thousands of them. We got state fairs going on right now. We have people showing off their preserves and being judged for how well their harvest has gone and so forth. And by telephone, we have one of the co-founders and the farm director of Calypso Farm and Ecology Center up in Fairbanks, Susan Wilsrud, with us. Susan, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, tell us, I guess, briefly to start with, how far out of town is Calypso Farm, and what does it do? Just your basic 101, what your mission is there.
Sure. Calypso is located fairly close to Fairbanks. We're about 15 miles west-ish of town, just outside of the town of Esther. We're up on the hill. We're actually a small working farm, just about 3 acres in production. But the real focus of what we do is education. We're an educational farm. We have on the order of about 2,000 kids who come out to the farm every year for field trips to really, you know, explore where their food comes, but also in the context of the boreal forest and ecosystems and kind of a holistic approach of, you know, where their food's coming from. And then the other thing that we're doing educationally on a big, you know, bigger scale is we run a network of school gardens here in Fairbanks, where we hire youth in the summer to maintain those gardens. And so, we're a diversified farm. Our mission is to encourage local agriculture through hands-on education, and we're doing that with workshops, field trips, school gardens. The farm itself grows 40 to 50 types of vegetables, and then an array of herbs and cut flowers. We have honeybees and dairy goats and sheep, and all of this on a really small, really a home, almost practically a homestead type scale. And one of the newest things that we're working on, and something that's been in the forefront of our consciousness since we started 10 years ago is seed growing. And we're now at a place, once our farm's established and we have all these things in place, in the last couple years we've been developing a garden that's dedicated specifically to seed saving.
Okay, and I want to get back to the seeds, but first I want to get a little bit more about this CSA, because I think when the first show we did on food security, we introduced this subject and we discovered that all the CSAs in Alaska get subscribed really early, and that includes Calypso Farms. And this is basically a scheme, and we've got it happening here with Full Circle Farms, which can be a controversial subject. But nonetheless, I'll say the people here in the office, we get our Full Circle Farm shipments in. And this is the idea that you put the money in ahead, it finances the farm, and then you get to harvest back. And
right, which is actually not what Full Circle does, because you don't have to pay at the beginning of the season, and you're not investing in a local farm. They are doing a subscription, and so I think there's a huge interest in the idea of having a weekly subscription. A true CSA is actually an investment in your local farm, which means you're investing seasonally, you're getting your share of the harvest. When there's bounty, you get that. When the weather's poor, you get less. And what you're doing is you're supporting local food security by keeping these local farms supported and in business. And so there are a number of CSAs around the state, and honestly, we've all been hurt by Full Circle and the massive numbers of boxes that are coming into town. So, and there's, I mean, that's enough about that, but it's really, I really want to make that clear.
Right. Well, I'm sure that it'll flame up on the email any second now as well. talk@abrn.org. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, a local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. We're really interested in what you do to preserve your harvest, and we're including the wild harvest in that. How could we not? Any trick that you want to share? And we're not the cooperative extension here. We're not going to come on here and tell you how to be absolutely safe in canning your foods and so forth like that. We just want to know what you do, how you do it, and anything you'd like to share from anywhere in the state, because I think it'll be interesting to people all over, whether this is meat, whether this is fish, whether this is something that you do with berries, whether it's something traditional, something somebody showed you. We're already seeing tremendous cross-cultural influences in food in Alaska. There are people from places in Asia who are out picking mushrooms that I never dreamed of, that's just one example of how probably Anchorage is the kimchi variety capital of the world right now in terms of ways of curing cabbage. We probably have more varieties of kimchi than North Korea. And so forth. We'd really like to hear from you. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. And with us is Susan Wilsrud, the farm director of Calypso Farm and Ecology Center. How many years has this been operating now?
10 years.
Wow. And are you, is it true what I said, that you basically just get fully subscribed? It's just not really much of a problem to...
It was true until this year, and actually we had a hard time filling our shares. We had a number of shareholders who said they would rather go with the convenience of Full Circle and the peaches and things we can't grow. And so we're actually considering dropping the numbers of our CSA and just seeking different outlets because of that pressure. And so I would have said absolutely 12 months ago, I would have told you it's not a problem. We just are packed. But we're really feeling it. And other farms, other CSA farms are all feeling it also. You know, so there's an enormous demand for local food, and people appreciate that. There will be other outlets, but the CSA right now is a little dicey.
Well, you also have this added benefit of the saving crops at the end of the year. Do you want to explain how that works?
Oh, sure. Do you mean just the opportunity for people to special order things to store?
Yeah.
Yeah, we've done it in different ways. Over the years, we've had in the past a special storage share where people could sign up for a set amount of money, and then for the last 8 weeks of the season, they'd get whatever we had a bounty of at that time. And that worked all right, but people said they felt like it was dictating their life because they weren't sure what they were going to get. And then they were loaded with beets, and they said, okay, I'm pickling beets. And it was really a regiment for people. So what we've switched to, based on the feedback from our shareholders, is a sign-up sheet. So people will special order at the beginning at a very reasonable price. It is an add-on price. They'll be able to order poundage of any of the crops that we have. And then we actually get that order in the spring, and we plant specifically for them so that we know we'll have X amount of carrots, beets, rutabagas, turnips, whether they're going to be storing it in their root cellar or preserving it. So that's been something that people have really enjoyed.
So what's good this year? What worked out well?
For us, it's been a really good season all the way around.
Well, you had all that heat and sun.
We did. We had moisture when we needed it. It was a little wet in July, but it's basically been a good season all around for most crops for us. It's been a really nice season.
All right. Well, now I want to turn to this business of the seeds because this kind of goes to the cutting edge. I have a feeling that our conversation with our listeners is probably going to drift back to this full circle issue because this is an emergent issue and clearly does need to be talked about. This is the first I've heard that this competitive pressure is starting to hurt. And I think that does need to be talked about, and I'm sure our callers will. But I want to get around to this because our subject is food security and putting food by. This idea of seeds, because this really goes beyond your backyard garden, I guess you would say. You have now a seed garden started, and maybe you can explain the idea because we're seeing not only in the food production area and food processing areas are we seeing consolidation in the industrial side, but even now the seed companies are starting to merge.
And
this can get a little scary when they don't even bother to tell you if your seeds are hybrids anymore.
Right. Yeah, the seed, that link is really our weakest part as far as we see it in terms of long-term sustainability for the farm. If we're having to bring in seed every year, we're completely dependent on those companies. And like you say, they have consolidated, and many of the seed companies are owned by, you know, big, or the few seed sources left, or many of them are owned by large agribusiness companies like Monsanto. And it just puts the small-scale grower at an enormous risk. And there are some incredible seed companies that we use. We mostly use out of the Northeast because of the comparable season. And there's one called Fedco out of Maine that we've been really happy with because they're very transparent and honest with their customers. And so there are still excellent seed sources, but it's still this point of vulnerability. And so it's been important to us to try to close that gap and increase our sustainability by being able to produce our own food, our own seeds. And what that does is it not only creates an inherent stability in our farm system, what it also does is we start producing, if we're growing our own seed, then we're developing seeds that are going to be very well suited for our particular area. And so you get, it's kind of a win-win situation. And you mentioned the seed garden and how it's, you know, moved beyond the back garden. Ironically, the back garden seed saving is where the richest heritage of our seed crops are. Even today, my daughter's piano teacher has been saving her tomato seeds for the last 15 years, and she gets in downtown Fairbanks an abundance of bright red tomatoes outside. And she's doing that by she's been saving back her seed every year, not as a botanist and a plant breeder, but as somebody who knows a good tomato and wants to save those seeds back. And, you know, she probably has the best tomato that you can grow in Fairbanks, at least in, you know, downtown Fairbanks. There's another woman who's been growing corn for decades, and she's got the best, sweetest, earliest ripening corn that you can get. You can't buy that from the Northeast or from a seed company. And so, and there's, you know, there's another farmer, and these are just the few I know of. I know there are dozens and dozens of farmers, gardeners doing this. There's a guy who's been seed saving for years who has just got incredible vegetables that you just can't get without doing that. And so that's why we've taken the step to actually dedicate a field to it. So our goal is to grow our own seed as much as possible for all of our crops and the school garden projects that we do. And then with the hope is that we will also have extra seeds available to just to keep as, you know, sort of a seed bank, but then also make it available to local growers, small-scale farmers and gardeners. And so that's our, it's a very long-term project. You know, we're, I consider myself a very novice seed saver. And so I'm just learning all the time. And, you know, we've got a couple dozen crops that I'm growing out right now, and I'm learning every day about how to do it right.
I'm wondering if there's any college in the country that teaches you seeds.
Well, there are a number of sustainable agriculture programs popping up, but they're all young and, you know, new programs. And really, it's, I think the best place to learn is from fellow seed savers, and that's really where I'm going. There's an organization called the Seed Savers Exchange out of Iowa, and that, for anybody who's interested in seed saving, that's really the first place to go, is get hooked into the Seed Savers Exchange, and that is like a phone book of people all over the country and internationally that are saving seed and then exchanging them amongst each other as individuals. And that's where I've gotten the most exciting seed varieties, is by just contacting someone, and some of them from Northern Europe and from the Northeast, and then those are what I'm hoping to then, you know, keep growing out here. So there are resources, but they're at this level, it's not university resources, it's fellow gardeners. That's where the wealth of knowledge is.
It strikes me that over time, the internet's going to be a great asset in this.
I think so.
Yeah, it's just a question of those tools really evolving too. As I guess, really the plants. I don't know if evolves quite the right word, or because they probably already have the genetic equipment to adapt. It's more adapting, really.
Right. Doing. And it happens quickly. I mean, I like to give the example to people that, so, you know, I've got a carrot that I really like. That's a heritage type carrot, and at the end of the season, I pull out all the carrots and I pick the ones I like the best. And then they go, for whatever that means for me, whether it's big or long or not curled, whatever, you know. And then I put them in my root cellar, and the ones that make it, I pull the ones that look the best the following April, I put into the ground. And so in one season's time, you've selected for the nicest looking carrots, the ones that did well, and then the ones that stored exceptionally well. And within a few generations, you've got a better carrot than you can get anywhere else.
Wow. That's fantastic. We're talking to Susan Wilsrud. She's farm director of the Calypso Farm and Ecology Center in Fairbanks. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. We are inviting calls on the subject of putting food by of any sort, subsistence food, food you grew, food security, getting that harvest to a point where we can use it over a longer period of the winter. Things are very, very seasonal in Alaska, and in food security, this has got to be one of the highest priorities in increasing our food security, although we're talking about things down the line like saving seeds and having the right kind of seeds and the best adapted seeds and so forth. All of that is enough for a talk show that we've gone on for a couple of months. Let's go to Sean, joins the program from Kotzebue. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Sean.
Morning.
Good morning.
No, I was just a little concerned. I guess I know they always had agribusiness and agriculture as an industry, but it's kind of went from being more compartmentalized. I guess I was used to the post-depression farm model, I guess. So it had taken off through the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, and like my grandmother used to have eggs and cream she sold on a weekly basis and kept everything in a root cellar. You know, the small town sale barns that bought the livestock from local producers, and, you know, you had the guys that were the buyers for the meat packing companies came in and tried to put together loads. That all went away, and now we've got hog confinement facilities that take over like 100 acres, and it's nothing but just buildings, sewage pits that are insane. And it's all changed to the point where it's kind of consolidated everything and condensed it and kind of made it less desirable, but more reliable. Does that make sense?
Yeah, more convenient, too, I think, is a lot of it. But
maybe not reliable when you think about the food safety concerns, but
right.
It does make it more widely available.
In the past, you know, agriculture was like little compartments, kind of like a compartment in a submarine. You know, if you lost the engine room, well, you still had the conning tower on the other ends of the submarine. You didn't go down. But with big business, you got all your eggs in one basket.
Boy, you can't say that again.
But you get what I mean? I mean, here in Kotzebue, we have bread that is baked. I have no idea where it's baked, but they used to have a bakery here, but they don't any longer. And I'm pretty sure that even downstate, they're eating bread that was not baked within a 200-mile radius of where they are. And that's scary.
Sean, these are
three calls.
These are great comments. Thank you.
It's just that when I grew up as a kid, if Armour had a meat recall, it was a regional recall. And now it's not. It could be schools in California or, you know, homes, a retirement home in Missouri. It's just kind of crazy in that regard because everything is so centralized now. It wouldn't take too much of a shakeup to contaminate the system.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you this, Sean.
Bulkheads.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Well worked out metaphor there. It wouldn't take much, you know, just basically a little freight space, and there might be some fresh vegetables coming your way from that guy in Bethel. You know, he's got really big plans, and I think maybe we have to look to doing things for ourselves more. Don't you think, Sean?
Yes. Actually, growing up as a kid, I was kind of bumming around through an old house that my grandparents had owned. It was an old abandoned farmstead, and upstairs in the attic was a old farm manual. And this was from like 1908 or something, and it was for a college course. It was like 101 courses in agriculture. And that book, even now, is still available, like on Amazon. It's Agriculture, It's Fundamental Principles. And in that book, you guys are talking about how you have to do your own, like, heirloom seeds. Well, in that book, it does it step by step, on how to select your own seeds. It's everything. And that was from the pre-electric era.
Wow.
Yeah. That's the usual. Those are some of the best resources.
It tells you how to even do. It tells you how to lay out your root cellars. It tells you how to lay out your kitchen. It's everything.
Okay, what's the book again, Sean?
Turn of the Century Agriculture.
What's the book, Sean?
Agriculture. It's Fundamental Principles by Andrew M. Soule. Soule.
Thank you so much, Sean.
And Kotzebue.
Thanks for your call. Actually, you know, that idea that he brought up about that it was all kind of compartmentalized before and it's kind of consolidated now, I think we all see that. But I'm wondering in terms, Susan Wilsrud, of your operation, Calypso Farm and Ecology Center, have you reached the point where you've got some livestock on there too?
Yeah, we have a really small flock of Shetland sheep. We also have a very small flock of dairy goats and some chickens. We keep some meat chickens, and it's all of those things are on a home scale. We use them for our educational purposes, but it feeds the folks that are my family and the people who live and work here on the farm. We aren't selling those products, and what we do is a series of workshops to other home scale, you know, people who are interested in keeping animals on that sort of for personal consumption and use and integration. And so we do, and those have been our most popular workshops in the last couple years. We do one on, you know, keeping sheep and goats, just an overview. We do another one on raising and butchering meat birds, those sorts of things, which are not hard to do, but we don't have many places to go to get that information. And so that's something that I think is a really great thing to be able to, the more, you know, self-sufficient people can be in a way that is really doable.
Yeah. There's the new ingredient, like with CSAs, seems to be loyalty. It doesn't work without it. I'm thinking, you know, what I grew up with the sound of a dairy next door to my house. The house was on the river, and so was the dairy. And the milk came in every day, and the milk went out every morning, and I had the sound of that dairy going up. Nowadays, I go back to my hometown in northern Pennsylvania, and some of the same pastures are still there, but they all got beef on them. Why? Because they can raise milk cows. They can get milk yield out of bigger operations, and it just put them all out of business. Those little farms couldn't make it anymore. The only thing that would stop that kind of trend is customer loyalty. That's the way
right.
It looks to me.
Yeah, and you know, eating close to home, knowing your farmer, you know, that all of those things, I think, are the solution to a healthier future.
Yeah, and well, we had the Matanuska Maid on here, and they said, well, let me tell you why you want to get our milk, even though it costs more. Well, they totally sold me on it. I wouldn't have any other milk.
Yeah. We have a little shop that's opened up here in Fairbanks, and if there's anyone listening from Fairbanks, I think they could attest to the incredible popularity. The place is called Homegrown, and the owner is Jeff Johnson, and he opened this. He's been in business for, I believe, less than a year, and he brings up milk from Matanuska, from the
Matanuska Creamery, right? Yeah.
Yep. And he also gets as much local meat as possible and local produce. And, you know, we're dropping off right after this program. I'm dropping off flowers down there. And it has been such a wonderful thing for the community. People are really thrilled to have this option because part of what's been missing with the consolidation and having only one grocery store and, like Sean was saying, from Kotzebue, no bakery, is people don't have these avenues anymore and they're really hungry for it. And that's what I think the popularity of Homegrown has shown. And it's not cheap, and it shouldn't be cheap. In order to keep this food, keep people in business and support local farmers, it can't be done on the industrial scale. You know, the little farmer's not getting the ag subsidy, and it's definitely a difficult thing, and people are starting to realize that it's worth it to pay more. It's an investment in the stability and the food security for your own community.
Security. That seems to be the byword. Susan Wilsrud of Calypso Farm and Ecology Center is our guest as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. If you smoke, odds are you want to quit. And if you want to quit, you're probably finding it tough to do. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. The average smoker tries 10 times before they quit for good. You can increase your chances by calling the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. Give it a shot. It's free and it works. Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-7848. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line.
Food security, the subject on Talk of Alaska today. We're talking with Susan Wilsrud of Calypso Farm and Ecology Center. And fundamentally what's happening, in order to secure our own food supplies, we have to deal with Alaska's seasonal qualities, which means we really need to think about how we store and preserve and keep food. And so we're talking about all those sorts of things. And I got a caller here from Kodiak. Steve, I'll be with you in a second, but first I want to introduce our next guest, who is Patrick Woodall, Director of Research of Food and Water Watch in Washington. Patrick, welcome to the Talk of Alaska.
It's great to be here, Steve. Thanks.
So, Patrick, I asked if you would join the program because we're talking about factory farming, and we have this giant egg recall. And apparently this giant egg recall is likely to get more giant. And apparently at least one of the companies that was responsible for the salmonella eggs, Wright County, has been in trouble before. And Patrick, what in the world is going on? We thought that there were agencies, government agencies, that were in charge of our food safety. Now we find out that Iowa is saying, oh, it's the Fed's job, and the Feds are saying, oh, it's Iowa's job, and nobody was doing it.
Well, I think the food safety regulators have been largely asleep at the switch, especially for eggs, where there little or no inspection. It's one of these examples where there's a split authority. The FDA is supposed to govern the eggs that you buy whole in the supermarket. USDA governs the eggs that go into processed eggs, egg powder for processed food, and they also govern the grade A and the size jumbo eggs. But it's largely fallen through the cracks. One of the facilities been inspected by FDA.
Okay, Patrick, so it's terribly important that they tell us whether it's grade B or grade AA or grade AAA or like that. I think they would never dream of falling down on the job on that. But when it comes to whether or not it's safe, somehow it's not my job.
Well, I think they're up until very recently, the egg safety regulations had not really been anywhere near adequate. And even still, there's very little inspection. Where a new rules went into effect in July that require the company to test for salmonella in the barn and on the eggs and on the chicks, and to make sure that eggs are refrigerated more quickly and to a cooler temperature, and if they find salmonella, to make sure that any salmonella-tainted eggs go into processed eggs where they're pasteurized and cooked before they go into the food supply and kill the salmonella. But we don't know. These rules just went into effect in July. How the extent to which FDA is going to inspect, do the necessary inspections to make sure that we can have a reliably safe food supply. And keep in mind, we're talking about 10 companies in the U.S. are 50% of the laying hens. So and these two firms are 23 million laying hens, and they probably produce about 1 in 11 eggs in America. So it's a very consolidated industry, but even with the small number of facilities, FDA has not been getting out to look at them.
Wow. And you're worried, obviously, that there's a budgetary factor here, and not to mention the deregulatory. We just put the regulation in place, and then we don't give them the power to actually enforce it.
Well, it's always a concern that the regulatory enforcement tools won't be there to make sure. This is a basic kind of function of government, to make sure that the food that we eat is safe every day. And that really requires people to go out and look at it. And so the companies, keep in mind, the companies resisted even this rule for over a dozen years. This was proposed in the late Clinton administration and has been languishing in FDA for, it was proposed in 99. So it's 11 years ago since this was proposed, and many of these ideas have been floating around since the late 1980s, and nothing has really happened. So this rule is in place now.
Yeah, did the farm lobby get involved in this? Is that what's going on? Because I watched farm lobby for many, many years, and it seems to me they've been totally eaten up by, at this point, there is no family farm lobby. It's all basically agribusiness now.
Well, I think there's, in this case, this is largely the egg company lobby.
They got their own lobby, of course.
Of the farm lobby do appear to be kind of captively owned by agribusiness, but this is the egg lobby, basically.
Whoa. And, you said that, you can take 10 farms own more than half of our laying chickens. If you expand it, 192 egg companies own 95% of our laying hens.
Right. Well, the top 10 companies have 136 million birds. These two firms that the recall controls, so far, they've recalled 550 million eggs, which is basically enough eggs to give every American a two-egg omelet. So it's a lot of eggs. And this is a kind of a serious concern that this kind of scale of this recall is still going on. This kind of exemplifies one of the big problems with a highly consolidated food system, because even one firm, a problem at one company, has ramifications throughout 20 states or 20, 25 states so far, and, you know, half a billion eggs have to be recalled. So when you have a situation like this, or a situation where one peanut butter plant provides ingredients for thousands and thousands of processed food items that all have to be pulled off the shelves, because once these things get into the food supply from this concentrated original source, they just go throughout the supermarkets of America and end up causing potentially causing risk to people in their kitchens.
Patrick Woodall is Director of Research for Food and Water Watch. Patrick, are there less depressing subjects that you get to research sometimes?
Yes, there are. I actually do work with a number of family farm lobby groups, including groups like the National Family Farm Coalition and National Farmers Union, who do represent small or medium-sized farmers, and I work with them to make sure that they have the ability to access markets and to be an important part of the food system and get a fair price for their cattle and their crops and their livestock. So that's a much more satisfying than having to talk to people about what really should be a pretty simple question. This is an issue that has been part of the American dialogue for more than 100 years. Teddy Roosevelt started much of the food safety apparatus, and still much of these important inspection issues remain today. It's still important that people at our ports look at the imports. It's still important that we go into the food processing factories and check to see that they're safe and clean. And that function makes people, provides a lot of confidence for consumers and reduces illness and death.
Susan, are you still with us from Calypso Farm?
Yes, I am.
You got any questions or inquiries of Patrick Woodall?
I guess one question would just be whether his organization works at all with real localized, real local scale farms and networks.
We do. We do work with a lot of people and farmers and small direct farms, CSAs, organic operators, and farmers who sell at farmers markets, and many small-scale and value-added producers, and we work very hard to ensure that they are that they get access to markets and are dealt with fairly by the kind of a USDA that seems all too often designed to meet the needs of big agribusiness and the most giant farms.
Boy.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Yeah, Patrick, I want to thank you for putting more light on the egg recall for us.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
All right. We've been talking with Patrick Woodall, Director of Research at Food and Water Watch in Washington, D.C. And on the phone we have Susan Wilrud of Calypso Farm and Ecology Center. So I guess you guys are not to the point where you're producing milk or milk products.
No. And for us at this point, there's actually a lot of restrictions on small-scale dairies, and I'm not the right person to give the details on this, but
right.
You know, hopefully someone might call in who's been working on this. There's been a lot of work going on lately on trying to change some of those regulations to open up the market for small-scale dairy producers. And so for us, we focus on home scale production in terms of any of the animal products, and then we actually, you know, provide these educational workshops for people who want to do the same. And in terms of commercial sale, it's all vegetable products and, you know, a few value-added products.
Let's go to Steve, joins the program from Kodiak. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Steve, and thanks for waiting.
Oh, hey, thanks for having me on. First off, I'd like to thank Patrick Woodall and Food and Water Watch for being there. Not very many people are looking out for our mains. And I wish there was an air watch, too, because food and water is like the two other staples. Anyway, I've been a fisherman all my life, sports subsistence and commercial. And I had a little tip, accidentally discovered a great quick way to freeze fish out in the bush or out on the beach a while back. I do some subsistence gill netting, and I took a garbage can full of cannery ice, shaved salt ice, which is easily accessible here in Kodiak, but any kind of ice will work. And I thought to drop the temperature of my, I put some water in there so it'd slush, and I'd catch a fish, bleed it, let it die, and then throw it in the slush ice. Well, I dumped a bunch of salt in there, and I threw a red salmon in my garbage can, and go to pick them out about 10 minutes later, and the thing is frozen solid.
Whoa.
That's just great. Like making ice cream, and it drops the temperature of that ice to the point where it just freezes instantaneously.
All you did is brine it up a little bit, and it dropped the temperature.
Yeah, and of course, freezing them in a home freezer, they're just exposed to air. The immersion in liquid is much more efficient. You know, it can be 60 degree air and you feel fine, but if it's 60 degree water, you get cold pretty quick. Anyway, the the ice crystals form quickly and they're very small. If ice crystals within the fish flesh, if they form slowly, the ice crystals are much bigger and they damage the cell walls and really degrades the quality of the product. So if you take I tend to catch fish a bunch at a time. And if you go stuff your home freezer, which is only a little storage freezer, with raw product, it bogs down. You can check it 3 days later, some of it's still not frozen. Now, those will form large ice crystals that break the cell walls, and it's not as good a product, really. When you thaw it out, all of a sudden you have a whole bunch of water coming off it. And that's why you don't freeze things, thaw them out, and freeze them again. It degrades the product.
This is great. So you're recommending this slush ice, slush brine, really, system to get them pre-frozen and then put them in.
Yes, brine frozen. I'm sorry for interrupting there.
Yeah.
I just bleed them, freeze them whole, and a year later I pull them out of the freezer and fillet them. They're perfect. I would suggest wrapping in plastic wrap just to keep what freezer burn does occur through the skin at a minimum.
Great. Thanks, Steve. Thanks for staying on the line.
I have a couple other points.
Okay.
As well, also with larger fish, I'll fillet them, and if I don't have a vacuum sealer, which I'm not too satisfied with the home vacuum sealers, if I have a large amount of fillets, I'll take them to the guys who do it commercially. They have the $10,000 vacuum sealer and blast freezer. It's just so much easier if I can just go catch them. Somebody else messes with them. Another way is to take your fillet, wrap it in plastic wrap, put it in a Ziploc bag, and then put it in and suck most of the air out, and then put it in your slush brine. And I'd also like to touch on food security. Being a commercial fisherman and having a diet that consists based on fish, basically, and venison when I can get it, I've been pushed out of a couple of fisheries by having them privatized or rationalized, where in such a program, generally the access to these commercial fish is given to a small set of people who then have exclusive access rights. And in crab rationalization, they don't even have to be present. In the halibut and black cod fishery, they're supposed to be present, but there are some loopholes that allow very large quota holders to not be there. Oftentimes, this is privatized. It's given to a corporation with numerous owners, and you can be deputized as an owner, or they can put this poundage in your name for a limited time so that you can go harvest it for them, and they charge you a lease fee. It's a royalty fee. And it average in black cod and halibut fishery is a 50% fee, and oftentimes higher, as high as 75%. And in the Bering Sea crab fishery, generally a red crab, the basis is a 70% lease fee, and oftentimes 275. And it's hard to make a living at that, so people will fish for even less. They're bidding against you. The fishermen harvesters are bidding against each other to get this quota to fish, and so the lease fee can go up even higher. But it just strikes me as having this resource privatized makes our food less secure.
I guess so.
Everybody, it used to be a public resource, but and they say it still is, but it can be lost in a divorce, sold, bequeathed to heirs, and oftentimes people figure out how not to be there. And you don't. There's no requirement in the crab fishery to be there in any way. We have crab quota holders that live in Hawaii, Arizona, don't need to own a boat anymore. Our crab fleet went from 261 to 60 for the red crab fishery in the first year of the fishery. And it's, not only is the food insecure, but it pulled the rug out from under about 1,000 crab crewmen. And so not only can you not access the product, you no longer have that income. So you're socially insecure as well as food-based.
Yeah, good point, Steve. Yeah, we got to take a break, but can you wind it up here?
Yeah, okay. So this type of program is being pushed nationwide, called Catch Shares. They're trying to do the entire East Coast, mm-hmm, and the Gulf, and they're using Alaska as a template. And I'd also like to recommend watching the movie The Corporation. It pointed out that in one country water was privatized, and it didn't work out too good.
Okay.
I recommend that too. I thought it was really good.
And Food Inc. I guess we ought to throw that one in too, huh?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thanks a lot, Steve from Kodiak. It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking food security, and we have got around to fish, and we've started to get the tricks and the tips like I was hoping we would as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
This is getting to be even more a hot topic than energy on Talk of Alaska. Alaskans have a lot to say about food security. Charles weighs in from Sitka saying, hey, did you know Alaska's emergency food supply in case of a major disaster is not located in Alaska? It's in Oregon, somewhere near Portland. So if we lose our transportation system because of a major earthquake, how are we supposed to get the food up here? Maybe parachute it out the back of a few planes? Yeah, that's not even a joke. Why isn't there a major warehouse for emergency food located in South Central with smaller emergency food supplies in Southeast, Interior, and Bush, Alaska? A few questions that need to be addressed from Charles. Well, I guess a pretty good point, don't you think, Susan Wilwood?
Yes, and actually along those lines, it's something that I've discussed with the owner of Full Circle Farm, is that it's a very vulnerable situation for us to have, it's a viable option at the moment, but in the event that there's a disaster, in the event that energy prices become, or transportation becomes not feasible economically, then all of those people getting the Full Circle share are out of luck. And, you know, so that's something to just think about when you're thinking about food security. And, you know, it's not a, you know, not a local farm. And it's interesting because even the talk of consolidation, although, you know, the actual Full Circle Farm is far from an agribusiness, they source from industrial agriculture, industrial organic sources. And it's, in a lot of ways, it is like, a little local example of consolidation.
So,
you know, the number of shares coming in from Washington just swamps the number of local CSAs, which means now, you know, folks that are thinking about starting up, that's not going to be their first choice because the pressure to try to break into that market is going to be difficult. And that means that's fewer farmers that are going to direct market in that way. You know, there'll be other ways, and they'll choose things like selling to homegrown market. They'll choose direct marketing through a farmer's market. They'll do other things. But it is that type of consolidation and, you know, food transportation, it all plays out, and it has its definite negative impacts. Even in the moment, it might feel like such a feel-good thing to be buying organic produce from Washington, but it's organic produce that has been first shipped from Chile, from Costa Rica, all over, and then shipped up here.
Yeah, and so, it's been pointed out to me also that Alaska is now the biggest customer for Full Circle Farms.
Oh, it's not now the biggest customer. It's been the biggest customer for quite a while.
Ooh.
And, you know, that's where they see a niche, and they've got it, and they're sending, you know, a decent quality product. Many of the items that you can get in your box, you can also buy at Fred Meyer, where you have more choice. You can get it when you want. You know, it's the same distributors. And so it's definitely the thing that is also...
They don't have Fred Meyer in Kotzebue, though.
Well, in Fairbanks you can. And someone said to me, who's getting a box in, you know, a bush community, she said, I cannot fathom why someone in Anchorage or Fairbanks would do this because they can buy the same stuff at Fred's.
All right, let's go to Phil, joins the program from Wasilla. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Phil.
Thanks, Steve. My wife and I try and do one or two steps more each year to increase our food security, I guess you could say, and probably about two-thirds of our non-whole grain food that we eat, we either grow or catch ourselves. And, you know, we got lots of methods of storing them.
Yeah, I like that freezer trick there. I didn't know that.
Oh, Steve had some great, practical knowledge to share on how to make freezing work when you don't have a freezer. But we, you know, one thing that we do with our carrots that keeps them really fresh is I try and get fresh dry sand every year and mix it, 90% sand and 10% Knick River silt, mix it up really good and store the carrots, lay them down inside of a box. Just so that they're just not touching each other, have some sand underneath them and then over them and then another layer, cover them, another layer, and they taste better than anything you'd ever buy from even Full Circle Farms all the way into the end of April.
And what is what's the purpose of the silt in there? Does it just change the bedding quality?
It makes a little bit more firm and adds a little bit of moisture.
Hmm.
Do you add any of your own moisture too?
Say what?
Do you add some water also to make it more moist?
No, the silt seems to hold its moisture really well,
mm-hmm.
And it's just that nine parts sand to one part river silt right from the bank of the river, mm-hmm. Seems to just add the right amount of moisture. We've experimented with different ratios.
What do you have for a root cellar there, Phil?
My garage near the wall, and I got to be careful if it gets too cold.
That's what I was thinking.
And what kind of containers do you use to put them in?
What kind of what?
What kind of containers are you using, like a rubber?
I've been using those plastic tubs that you can get at Fred Meyer's. I used to use older coolers, and I'm thinking of going back over to that because we had an experience this last winter of some of them getting a little bit too cold, and we lost them. And mm-hmm. if they'd had that little wall of insulation, they would have stored better. And our potatoes, we don't wash them when we dig them up, and we put them in cardboard, like beer-type boxes, so they're not too big to move around. But we keep them with the dirt on and keep them closed and keep them near a wall, too, and they store really well. Our beets, some of them we store fresh, some of them we can or pickle. We eat a lot of them. Beans, not looking too good this year, but we usually can those. Starting our individual lettuce plants inside in March and then transplanting those first indoors in our greenhouse and then outdoors. And we've had like five different complete crops of lettuces and things like that. I think I'm on my 14th generation on my cilantro seeds and my 7th generation on arugula seeds. And
our
new step, and then we're switching over to heirloom tomatoes. We started, I think it's Baker Farms is the name of the
Baker Creek in Missouri.
Yeah, and they're heirloom black from Tula, and I think it's purple Cherokee tomatoes.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, Stupice are wonderful because they come out so quickly.
Yeah.
But those are our main crops this year. And what we're going to be doing this next year, especially after this egg thing sort of got us going, is we're going to clear out a couple of old trucks from the driveway and put a chicken house in there for at least a half a dozen chickens.
I'm loving it. Thanks a lot. I'm going to try and get one more call in there, Phil. Thanks.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks for your call. Ginger in Fairbanks, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hey, thank you so much for having me, and I was so excited to hear this topic being discussed. I started as an amateur gardener a few years back and then started researching fertilizer, which led me to become a worm composting company up here for a little bit.
Ah.
And I was just tired of the labor-intensive work that it offered, but I really wanted to recycle, so I really jumped into poultry ownership this year. And boy, I'm so excited by owning chickens. It's such a huge endeavor for my family. Not only does it provide food security, but I was even half-joking, thinking and wishing that maybe the borough would jump in with these neighborhood coops and have the community step up just like Calypso's school gardens and do a kind of a communal chicken coop arrangement.
God, wouldn't that be great?
A great
idea.
It
would just be wonderful for recycling. I mean, I, as a Fairbanksan, as an Alaskan, really believe strongly in recycling. And I couldn't believe how quickly chickens eat compared to worms. And while I love what they provide, the great fertilizer, I just couldn't believe how rewarding it was to own chickens.
Oh, Ginger, wait till you get your tilapia. That's what I have to say. Susan Wilsford, I want to thank you so much for being on the program today from Calypso Farms. We got to wrap it up and get out of here. But, Ginger, I promise that we will be back with more food security programs because it seems like people got a lot more tips to share, and we just really scratched the surface. Thanks again, Susan.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, Talk of Alaska, Josh Edge and Dave Waldron on the controls and BD Trantina on the phones. Thanks for listening. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA. If you smoke, odds are you want to quit. And if you want to quit, you're probably finding it tough to do. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. The average smoker tries 10 times before they quit for good. You can increase your chances by calling the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. Give it a shot. It's free and it works. Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-7848. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.